You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
We had fired only a few rounds before some of us noticed Generals Mansfield and Crawford and other mounted officers over on the knoll. Mansfield at once came galloping down the hill and passed through the scattered men of our right companies, shouting, "Cease firing! You are firing into our own men!" He rode very rapidly and fearlessly till he reached the place where our line bent. Captain Jordan now ran forward as far as the fence and insisted that General Mansfield should look and see. He and Sergeant Burnham pointed out the particular men of the enemy who were not 50 yards away that were then aiming their rifles at us and at him. Doubtless the general was wounded while talking with Jordan. At all events, he was convinced and remarked, "Yes, you are right." He then turned his horse and passed along to the lower land where the fence was down and attempted to go through, but the horse, which also appeared to be wounded, refused to step into the trap-like mass of rails or to jump over. The general thereupon promptly dismounted and led the horse into Sam Poffenberger's field. I met him at the gap in the fence. As he dismounted, his coat blew open, and I saw that blood was streaming down the right side of his vest. The general was very quick in all his motions and attempted to mount as soon as the horse had got through the fence, but his strength was evidently failing, and he yielded to the suggestion that we should take him to a surgeon. The road had appeared to be full of ambulances a half hour before, but all were gone now, and we carried the general clear to Sam Poffenberger's woods. An ambulance was found just inside the woods, a few steps north of where Poffenberger's gate now hangs. The young doctor put a flask to the general's mouth. The whiskey, or whatever it was, choked the general and added greatly to his distress. We put the general into the ambulance, and that was the last I saw of him. Lieutenant John M. Gould, 10th Maine Infantry, Crawford's Brigade.
Soon in the morning the firing commenced, and very soon our regiment was under fire, the balls whizzing over us and wounding and killing many of our brave boys. Here our gallant and much-loved Captain Bouchel got severely wounded in the mouth and had to be carried off the field. We were ordered by the left flank and were very soon into the engagement. I commenced loading and shooting with all my might, but my gun got choked the first round, and I picked up the gun of one of my comrades who fell by my side and continued to fire. Here I could see the second line of battle of the enemy, and when their men would fall, the rest would close in and fill their places. Their first line was lying by a fence, and I could see the old stars and stripes waving over them. I fired as near as I could aim at the men around the flag. I do not know whether I killed anyone or not. During this time, our regiment got cut up very severely, and the regiment was ordered to retreat back when we met reinforcements coming in, and I was glad to see them, for I was nearly tired to death, not having hardly anything to eat for 4 or 5 days. We then marched up on a hill out of danger where we stacked arms and rested a while. We received more ammunition and was ordered back to our position in the line of battle. I often looked at the sun and longed for night to come so the firing would cease. As we marched back to our position, General Lee met us and said, "Go in, cheerful boys. They are driving them back on the right and left, and we need a little help in the center." Private Calvin Leach, 1st North Carolina Infantry, Ripley's Brigade.
Hey everyone. Thanks for tuning in to episode number 193 of our Civil War podcast. I'm Rich.
And I'm Tracy. Hello, y'all. Welcome to the podcast. Over the last two episodes, we looked at the fighting at the Battle of Antietam on the morning of Wednesday, September 17, 1862, as Hooker's First Corps attacked the Confederate left on the northern end of the battlefield. As y'all recall, Hooker failed to coordinate his attack with Mansfield's nearby 12th Corps, and so Stonewall Jackson, who was in command of that part of the Confederate line, was able to counter each Federal advance, meeting force with force.
When we left off at the end of the last show, it was about 7:30 a.m., and there on the northern end of the battlefield, both Jackson's and Hooker's commands were shattered and spent after an hour and a half of ferocious combat. Stonewall's casualties came to around 3,000 men, while Hooker's losses were about 2,600 men. The Federals had a foothold in the northern part of the West Woods, and some of the Confederates occupied a portion of the East Woods. But little else had changed from the positions each side had held at dawn when the killing had begun.
In those early morning hours when the fighting had been at its most furious, a couple of key Confederate counterattacks by Stark and by Hood had blunted the Union assaults. The sight of Hood's division swarming to the attack from the West Woods behind the Dunker Church had finally spurred George McClellan to action, and at 20 after 7, orders were given to Edwin Sumner to take his Second Corps troops across the Antietam and march to Hooker's support.
But not the entire Second Corps, however. Little Mac's orders specified that one of Sumner's three divisions must be held back east of the creek for defensive purposes until Morrill's division of Fitzjohn Porter's Fifth Corps came up from its bivouac a mile to the rear to replace it. By holding back one of Sumner's divisions until Morrill was brought up to take its place in the reserve, McClellan's inherent caution is evident, as is his mindset that Antietam wasn't a battle that was his to win, but a fight that he couldn't afford to lose.
Bull Sumner, as we said last time, had had his men ready to march at dawn, and now that he'd finally received orders from McClellan, he got his men moving at once. Well, two divisions, since he had to leave one behind. But even moving with all possible speed, Sumner was starting from a point that was 2 miles away from the East Woods and the West Woods in the cornfield, and so it would be some time before he could reach the scene of the fighting.
And McClellan still issued no orders to Burnside and the Ninth Corps to move against the other end of the Confederate line. And so, while frenzied, fierce fighting had taken place north of Sharpsburg, the rest of the battlefield, except for intermittent shelling, remained silent. As we said last time, this failure on Little Mac's part to coordinate the actions of the different parts of his army allowed Robert E. Lee to start pulling some units from the quiet right end of the rebel line and shift them north to shore up the embattled Confederate left.
Both sides were feeding fresh troops into the combat on the Confederate left. Lee had troops marching north to aid Stonewall Jackson, but closer to the scene of the action, Confederate Major General D.H. Hill, commanding the troops in the center of Lee's line, saw Hood launch his counterattack out of the West Woods, and Hill advanced one of his own brigades under Brigadier General Roswell Ripley to the pasture south of the cornfield to support Hood.
But Hood's assault was driven home with such speed that it had reached its furthermost point and was already falling back before Ripley arrived on the scene. These new rebel troops, however, did arrive in time to stop the advance of the Yankees, who came through the cornfield on the heels of Hood's retreating men. After personally positioning Ripley's troops, D.H. Hill galloped back to bring up two more of his brigades.
At the same time, Mansfield's 12th Corps was approaching the battlefield from the north. Whatever role Hooker and or McClellan had originally envisioned for the 12th Corps, its mission now was to shore up Hooker's wrecked formations.
In his book on Antietam, Landscape Turned Red, Stephen Sears writes, quote, Mansfield's men were roused from their bivouacs a mile or so to the rear of the First Corps as soon as the battle opened and immediately ordered to arms. They formed columns and started to march to the sound of the firing, but no one seemed to know what was going on, and there were long halts. Officers would let the men break ranks to make breakfast and boil coffee, but they no sooner got their fires kindled than the order came to move out. A few hundred yards advance would be made, and then the whole scene was repeated. In later years, when veterans of the Corps put down their recollections of Antietam, a number made a point of noting how many times they were frustrated that day trying to make morning coffee. It sounds like these guys had the same relationship to coffee that you do.
Yeah, I definitely need my morning coffee.
Yes, you do. Dear listeners, I actually don't drink coffee, but Tracy drinks enough for both of us.
I won't deny it. Okay, so at any rate, during one of those halts during the Second Corps' fitful march to the front, Lieutenant Colonel Wilder Dwight of the 2nd Massachusetts, like a good many other men, took the time to jot a few lines in his diary or to start a letter home. Dwight wrote, "Dear Mother, it is a misty, moisty morning. We are engaging the enemy and are drawn up in support of Hooker, who is now banging away most briskly. I ride in the saddle to send you my love and to say that I am very well so far."
When Mansfield went on ahead to learn where to place his men, Hooker explained that he needed help everywhere to support the hold he had won in the West Woods and to prevent any further breakthrough in the East Woods or through the cornfield. Mansfield then rode back to hurry his troops forward. In a considerable piece of understatement, he told his subordinates, "There is work for us to do up there."
The 12th Corps was the smallest in the Army of the Potomac and seemingly the most unpromising for the work facing it. Fully half of the 7,200 men in the Corps were going into battle for the first time, including five regiments of new troops mustered in less than a month before. And those men who had seen action before were from Nathaniel Banks' old command, and so bore an unhappy legacy of defeat at the hands of Stonewall Jackson in the Shenandoah Valley the previous spring, and more recently in the Second Bull Run campaign.
58-year-old Joseph Mansfield had been in the old Army 40 years as an engineer officer and in routine postings, and this was his first important field command. He had seen some limited action during the Mexican-American War, but desperately wishing to crown his career by leading men in combat here in the Civil War, Mansfield had pulled many strings in Washington before finally receiving command of the 12th Corps. He'd arrived only on September 15th, though, so he hardly had time to get his bearings before leading the Corps into battle at Antietam.
Mansfield's lead brigade contained three new regiments of raw troops and their equally green officers. They had virtually no training, and in their inexperience, they had to be led to their positions by the generals. Brigadier General Alpheus Williams, the divisional commander, took one of them in hand and personally led it to the front. He later wrote to his family saying, quote, "I got mine in line pretty well by having a fence to align it on."
Williams went on to explain that the problem with so many of the new Union troops that day, quote, was that in attempting to move them forward or back or make any maneuver, they fell into inextricable confusion and fell to the rear, where they were easily rallied. The men were of an excellent stamp, ready and willing, but neither officers nor men knew anything.
Meanwhile, Mansfield was personally positioning other regiments in the East Woods. On one of these missions, he noticed that the 10th Maine had opened a steady fire at targets amongst the trees. Having just heard from a First Corps officer that some of Rickett's Federals were thought to still be in the woodlot, Mansfield quickly rode over, shouting that the troops were shooting their own men.
But these Maine soldiers had been in battle before, and in that scene in the quote I read at the top of the show, some men from the 10th pointed out Mansfield's mistake. The general took a closer look and admitted they were right, but just then a bullet struck him in the chest. He was carried to the rear and placed in an ambulance and taken to a field hospital where his wound was diagnosed as mortal. Mansfield died the next day, having commanded the 12th Corps for just 48 hours.
Just before he was hit, Mansfield had led one of the new regiments, the 128th Pennsylvania, to the front and was in the process of posting it in the East Woods and in Farmer Miller's pasture north of the cornfield. For a well-drilled outfit, there was nothing very much to deploying from column of march into line of battle, but for these greenhorns, it was something entirely new. Immediately after forming in mid-August, the 128th was sent to Washington, where instead of drilling, they were put to work on the Capitol's fortifications during the Second Bull Run crisis.
Now, at Antietam, just as the 128th Pennsylvania attempted to deploy into line, a blast of rebel musketry killed their colonel and wounded the second in command, and the maneuver dissolved into total confusion. It was only with the aid of experienced officers and sergeants from nearby regiments that they eventually formed into a semblance of a battle line. The 128th's ranking officer then concluded it was better to attack than continue to take casualties to no purpose where they stood. So the Pennsylvanians advanced bravely into the cornfield. Like so many other Yankees that morning, they came out of the corn to encounter a storm of rebel fire. It was too much for them, and they turned and fled back through the corn and out of the battle, having lost 118 men and accomplished nothing whatsoever.
Alpheus Williams took over command of the 12th Corps after Mansfield was shot. Williams found Hooker out in the middle of a plowed field and received his instructions in the midst of what he described as, quote, a very unpleasant shower of bullets, end quote. John Gibbon and George Meade rode up to call for support from the 12th Corps. Like Gibbon, Meade had been in the thick of the action during the Confederate counterattacks, and a bullet hole in his hat testified to at least one close call.
As this cluster of federal generals held their hurried conference, a buildup of rebel strength could be seen to the south, just beyond the cornfield, and Hooker told Gibbon and Meade, "Gentlemen, you must hold on until Williams's men get up."
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
That buildup of rebel strength to the south beyond the cornfield that Hooker observed was 3,400 of D.H. Hill's men. From Ripley's brigade, which was already on the scene, and from two additional brigades, led by Brigadier General Alfred Colquitt and Colonel Duncan McRae, advancing toward the cornfield. Hill's men were reestablishing the Confederates' northward-facing line, extending from the Hagerstown Turnpike over to the East Woods, where some of Hood's men were still holding on. As the 12th Corps took over from the 1st Corps, the fierce fighting flared up once more. The sound of it, Alpheus Williams wrote, was as if every building on Broadway in New York City tumbled down simultaneously, quote, and amidst this, hundreds of pieces of artillery, right and left, were thundering a sort of bass to the infernal music.
Colquitt's Georgians and Alabamians advanced into the cornfield and became locked in a savage fight with three regiments of Federals from Brigadier General George H. Gordon's brigade. Those regiments, the 2nd Massachusetts, 3rd Wisconsin, and 27th Indiana, had rushed into the Miller pasture north of the cornfield to plug the hole that Hood's men had punched in the center of the 1st Corps' line.
The pasture was on higher ground than the cornfield, and so Gordon's Yankees were silhouetted and a clear target for Confederate musketry and artillery, but they never wavered. George Smalley, the newspaper correspondent who had attached himself to Hooker's headquarters, wrote that, quote, "The whole line crowned the hill and stood out darkly against the sky, but lighted and shrouded over in flame and smoke," end quote. During the fighting here, the 27th Indiana's casualties included Corporal Barton Mitchell, who had discovered the lost copy of Lee's Special Orders No. 191, and his friend, Sergeant John Bloss. They were both wounded. The company commander to whom they had taken their find, Captain Peter Kopp, was killed.
The quote I read at the top of the show that a private in the 1st North Carolina of Ripley's brigade wrote in his diary is from this part of the battle. As the fighting intensified, Colonel William DeRosset of the 3rd North Carolina, another of Ripley's regiments, came on a new man in his command pacing back and forth behind the firing line and looking frustrated. When asked why he wasn't shooting, he said that with all the smoke, he couldn't see anything to aim at, and he hated to waste his ammunition. He was told to lie down and look for blue Yankee breeches under the smoke, and soon he was firing steadily.
That fellow was one of 100 new soldiers in the 3rd North Carolina, and Colonel DeRosset testified that they did well in their first battle. These new men were conscripts raised under the Confederacy's draft law passed the previous spring. It's worth noting that the Confederates used new men as replacements in veteran units rather than forming them into all new regiments as the Federals routinely did. In this way, the new Confederates picked up basics of soldiering much more rapidly under the instruction of experienced comrades and officers.
McClellan had made strenuous efforts to persuade the War Department in Washington to follow the Confederate example, but without success, since Northern governors found there was far more political advantage and patronage in raising new units than in supplying replacements for their state's old regiments.
Although the Confederate system was far superior to federal practice, it couldn't entirely do away with the problem of inexperienced men in combat. Colonel McRae's command, the 3rd of D.H. Hill's brigades to go into action here, also had a good many conscripts intermixed with veterans in its ranks. But in this case, the entire brigade, old hands as well as new, was entering battle still badly shaken from its experience at South Mountain 3 days before. There, it was flanked and routed, and its commander, Samuel Garland, killed. Here at Antietam, no sooner had this brigade entered the East Woods than a large body of Yankees was seen approaching from off to the right. A nervous young captain in the 5th North Carolina cried out that they were about to be flanked again. There were some 70 or 80 conscripts in the regiment with still vivid memories of South Mountain, and suddenly they broke and rushed to the rear, carrying the rest of the regiment and the better part of the brigade with them. Colonel McRae watched, mortified, as his men fled, admitting that it was a, quote, unutterable stampede.
Many of McRae's men didn't stop running until they reached the streets of Sharpsburg. D.H. Hill had posted McRae's brigade in the East Woods as a guard against any federal flanking movement, and when it broke and ran, it opened the door wide to just that possibility. As it happened, the Yankees had a general on the scene who was alert to the opportunity and fully capable of exploiting it.
The brigade advanced through a cornfield in front, which until then had been occupied by the enemy. It was full of their dead and wounded, and one of our sergeants took a regimental color there, belonging to the 11th Mississippi. Beyond this cornfield was a large open field, and such a mass of dead and wounded men, mostly rebels, as were lying there, I never saw before. It was a terrible sight, and our men had to be very careful to avoid treading on them. Many were mangled and torn to pieces by artillery, but most of them had been wounded by musketry fire. We halted right amongst them, and the men did everything they could for their comfort, giving them water from their canteens and trying to place them in easy positions. There are so many young boys and old men among the rebels, and it makes you pity them all the more as they lie moaning on the field. The wounded rebels were always as surprised and grateful as men could be at receiving attention from us, and many said that all they wanted was to get into our hospitals and wished they had never fired a shot at us. One boy, 17 or 18, told Morse he had only left North Carolina 3 weeks ago and how his father and mother grieved at his going. Captain Robert Gould Shaw, 2nd Massachusetts Infantry, Gordon's Brigade.
We had now been engaged, as afterwards learned, almost 3 hours fighting desperately without intermission. Most of the men had exhausted their ammunition, and all had exhausted themselves in their efforts to drive the enemy from his position. Before accomplishing this, however, the Union General Greene, with 2 fresh brigades, made a terrible and overwhelming attack on our front, which, together with the fire on our right flank and rear, caused us to fall back. General Hood kept his staff busy going over the field, directing the scattered men of the division to assemble in rear of Dunker Church. As Captain Karsner, Lieutenant Dan Turner, and I were slowly wending our way in that direction, a shell of the enemy burst near us. A fragment struck Karsner's too prominent nose. The shock was so great it knocked him a severe fall at full length upon his back. We ran to him, thinking he was killed. On examination, as he still remained where he fell, though bleeding profusely, we found the wound very slight. He presented, lying there, a most ludicrous sight, so much so that it was impossible to avert a smile on our part. He imagined that the missile had gone entirely through his head, so great was the shock, and when he observed that we entertained so little feeling for a dying comrade, promptly arose, and still quite dazed, abused us soundly for our lack of sympathy. After being convinced that it was nothing serious, he soon regained his usual merry mood. Just then, General Hood was seen approaching from the rear. Lieutenant Turner remarked, "Captain, wipe that blood from your face before General Hood reaches us." "No," he said, "I will see if I can make him sympathize with me." He then, with his hands, smeared the clotted blood thickly over his face. General Hood exclaimed as he rode up, "My God, Captain, I am sorry to see you so seriously wounded." "Yes, General," he said, "I came very near getting my face shot off." General Hood was as sympathetic as a woman. Lieutenant Robert T. Coles, 4th Alabama Infantry, Law's Brigade.
At age 61, Brigadier General George S. Greene, commanding the 2nd Division of the 2nd Corps to reach the scene of the fighting, was the second oldest field commander in the Army of the Potomac, but he was also one of its most capable and hard-driving. After the flight of McRae's Confederates, Greene pressed his lead brigade, under Colonel Hector Tyndall, into the East Woods and pivoted it to face west so that it would take the rebels in the cornfield in the flank.
Positioned on the outside of the pivot was the 28th Pennsylvania, a regiment going into combat for the first time, and so large, with nearly 800 men, that when McRae's nervous rebels had seen it coming, they had thought it was an entire brigade, and so the 28th's size alone had much to do with sending them stampeding for the rear.
Although these Pennsylvanians were new to battle, they were well drilled, and they wheeled precisely into line alongside the 3 Ohio regiments brigaded with them, and they unleashed a killing volley. Their targets, scarcely 30 yards away, were Colquitt's Confederates at the northern boundary of the cornfield, who were fully focused on their fight with Gordon's Yankees, who were up in the Miller pasture.
The colonel of one of the Ohio regiments later recalled how, quote, "The sight of the fence where the enemy was standing when we gave out first fire was awful beyond description. Dead men were literally piled upon and across each other. We had been enabled to pour a volley into an entire line at a few rods' distance.
Tyndall's brigade followed up their fire with a charge west into the cornfield, and Colquitt's rebels met them head-on in a swirl of stabbing bayonets and clubbed muskets. But the weight of the Federal flank assault, combined with the fire of Gordon's Yankees on their front, was soon too much for the hard-pressed Confederates, and they fell back through the corn in disorder. Colquitt's brigade as a whole lost more than half its numbers in the brutal combat here.
Green sent Colonel Henry J. Stainrick's brigade in an even wider turning movement to the south, so that it emerged at the Smoketown Road and the Mumma Farm. The advance of these Federals forced the last of Hood's rebels to surrender their foothold in the East Woods.
All three of D.H. Hill's brigades were in full retreat now, pressed hard by the advancing Union troops. A two-gun section of Confederate artillery sent forward by S.D. Lee was too slow to withdraw and was captured by men of the 28th Pennsylvania. A New Yorker in Stainrook's brigade remembered that they charged ahead after the retreating rebels so recklessly that General Greene had to ride after them, calling out, "Halt, 102nd. You are bully boys, but don't go any farther. Halt where you are. I will have a battery here to help you."
Green's advance reached the edge of the plateau-like area just to the east of the Dunker Church, where S.D. Lee's Confederate guns had been positioned all morning. But now, as Green's Federals approached, Colonel Lee had to give up his excellent firing platform and pull his batteries back beyond the woods.
The 125th Pennsylvania, another of the new 12th Corps regiments, was ordered to push on across the Hagerstown Turnpike and took up position in the West Woods around and to the north of the church. It was now close to 9 a.m., and the 12th Corps had turned the battle in the Union's favor. If it was called into action too late to sustain the momentum of 1st Corps' attack, it was at least in time to rescue Hooker's wrecked formations. And although the 12th Corps, like the 1st Corps, made its fight unsupported and alone, its advance nevertheless set the stage for a Federal breakthrough here on the northern part of the battlefield.
The stage was set for a Federal breakthrough here on the northern part of the battlefield because even though the assaults by the 1st Corps and 12th Corps were uncoordinated and unsupported, their successive hammer blows, after 3 hours of terrible fighting, had finally driven the rebels from all of the ground east of the Hagerstown Turnpike, that is, from the cornfield and the East Woods and the pasture and the Mumma Farmstead south of them.
By about 9 a.m., some 8,000 men lay dead or wounded or were missing there on the hellish landscape at the northern end of the battlefield. The losses were about equally divided between Union and Confederate. Hooker would later say he had never seen, quote, "a more bloody, dismal battlefield," end quote. The cornfield had been at the center of the maelstrom, and among the trampled stalks and around its four sides, the dead and wounded carpeted the ground. At one spot at the northern edge of the cornfield could be seen an almost perfect row of rebel dead. They were Evander Law's Mississippians, caught in one devastating volley during Hood's counterattack.
At the southern edge of the corn were casualties from a dozen Yankee regiments, struck down in their repeated attacks. A Massachusetts soldier from Ricketts' division, recalling the charges and countercharges there, said, quote, "And so it went till the ground was fought over two or three times. The field beyond the cornfield was filled with dead men, both Yank and Reb. Dan Warren counted 33 dead Rebs in the length of four fence rails," end quote. And then over along the Hagerstown Turnpike, bodies were in heaps all along the road, and there were dead men draped over the high post and rail fences that bordered the turnpike, killed in the act of climbing over while either in pursuit or retreat.
It was close to 9 o'clock now, and Stonewall Jackson's and D.H. Hill's thinned ranks were facing disaster. It was clear that the battered, reeling Confederates here couldn't stop the 12th Corps' advance. With the 125th Pennsylvania at the Dunker Church and Green's division within supporting distance nearby, Fighting Joe Hooker, still riding to and fro on his eye-catching white horse, could sense victory within his reach. As Hooker said later, at that moment, he, quote, counted on either capturing their army or driving them into the Potomac.
That means it's time for this episode's book recommendation. And our recommendation this time is Landscape Turned Red, The Battle of Antietam by Stephen W. Sears.
This isn't the first book by Stephen Sears that we've recommended. We've previously suggested you might check out his biography on McClellan, and then there was To the Gates of Richmond, his book on the Peninsula Campaign.
And also Controversies and Commanders about the Army of the Potomac.
Yep, and so now we're pleased to recommend Sears' book on Antietam, Landscape Turned Red.
Don't forget you can find all of our book recommendations at the podcast website, which is www.civilwarpodcast.org.
Also at the website, there are always photographs and maps and portraits and whatnot, so you can always head over there and peruse those when you have a few minutes to kill.
There are also links to the show's Facebook page and Twitter feed.
And, of course, the website is where you can sign up to become a member of the Strawfoot Brigade. It's $5 a month, and that gives you access to all the members' episodes, of which there are now 52, I think. And besides that, you'll be supporting the podcast and helping Tracy and me continue with this project that we're now over 4 years into.
We just want to say thank you to the newest members, Carrie Ann and Peter, and a special shout-out to Adam and John over in Singapore.
Yeah, Adam was a special friend of the podcast even before joining the Strawfoot Brigade. Well, anyway, thanks to all of you for listening to this episode of The Civil War, 1861 to 1865, a history podcast. Tracy and I do hope you'll join us again next time as we continue with the story of the Battle of Antietam. But until then, take care.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.